Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. With the baseball season put to rest, we concentrate this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast on football.
What? Or is it hike? Honestly,
you don't hike. It's it's hot hike.
I never played. I don't know.
In our Out of the Park segment today, we're going to check in with our gridiron guru, Ross Kirkcap, to discuss late season football field management.
Yay, Ross. Hey, Paul. I bet you thought I'd forgotten all about the Herp Science segment. I haven't!
God.
Today we're going to return to wear tolerance. Yay! We're going to talk about actually what's going on inside the turf that makes it more or less susceptible to wear, whether Paul likes it or not.
Do we get to talk about centrifuges today?
If you're lucky.
Well, all that science and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. I'm Paul Sawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, and I'm joined, as usual, by Teresa Beyer, my very talented co-host and producer of the show.
Well, hey, Paul. How's it going?
How's it going for you? She's in the middle of her pregnancy with her second child. How are things? Why don't we update the listeners as to how excited and thrilled and energetic you feel right now?
I feel like I'm going to fall over from exhaustion.
As you prop yourself up over there.
I am propped up. It's really funny.
The good news is we can put the Major League Baseball season to rest. And I'm thrilled to say that your predictions and mine came true. we were both leaning and pulling for the Kansas City Royals, and my long-suffering groundskeeper friend Trevor Vance looks like he's finally going to get his World Series ring.
Yay.
So I'm pretty excited about that.
First round's on him.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that this household, it was also bummed for Bill. You know, it's actually one of the problems of working in such a small industry is, you know, you're winning and losing along with your friends on both sides, and it's tough, you know, all season long. You're happy to be winning, but you're sad because you're affecting somebody else's.
Sure.
You know, I lost the word. I'm going to blame the baby.
Well, and I'm not taking anything away from Bill Deacon. He's an excellent groundskeeper and guy. You know, both Trevor with the Royals and Bill Deacon with the Mets did a fabulous job with their fields, and I'm sure. Right now, they're working to shut theirs down for the season. Luckily for them, you know, we've got that strong El Nino going this fall, and that'll help them to buy them plenty of time to complete their work before Old Man Winter decides to, well, if he decides to come to their parts of the U.S. later on this year.
Yeah, speaking of the El Nino, I was thinking about this the other day. Everyone always says, and I just said, the El Nino, which... All right, small point of grammar annoyance. The El Nino means the little boy. It's kind of like
you're
Ross,
right.
You know.
Right. I didn't even think about that.
There are a lot of words that we've taken from different cultures where we do that, where we end up using the part, and then we put our the in front of it. I can't figure out a way to say it better, but it still bothers me.
I never thought of it that way. I guess it takes somebody who's really anal at grammar to pick that out.
I'm not, though. I'm really horrible at grammar. But this one thing in particular just really gets me.
Well, let's move on. Let's leave the summer sports behind, shall we, and move on. But I want to say something. You know, we're moving into the late fall and winter here. And, you know, when you talk to guys, when you talk to your cohorts down south, the groundskeepers down south, they're going, oh, God, I'm glad I don't have to deal with that winter that you guys deal with up there. And I think to myself, yeah, it's a real bitch. You know,
I sense a little sarcasm there, Paul.
Do they realize that we get a slow period where we can sit back and, you know, kind of gather ourselves together again and get our sanity back. We're not working these long hours. You know, I loved the fall and winter time with the, when I was with the Orioles. You know, I took all my vacation then. I had, you know, typically I would take off once we had the ballpark shut down. You know, I would take off from Thanksgiving all the way to New Year's. And then when we were working in the winter, you know, we were typically coming in for 5-6 hours max. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you know, there's nothing going on. We're working on getting our equipment ready, doing our ordering, going to conferences, going to speak at conferences. Mm-hmm. We were doing all the fun stuff and having literally hardly any stress. The guys down south are still, they got people doing, you know, if you're far enough south, you're still got activities going on in your fields. You never get a break.
We've got a lot of snow to move up here, you know, but yeah, it's not as pressure driven as it is having games or having activities or having events. One of my clients, they wanted to put an event on his field over the winter. They wanted to do a beer fest on his field. And he's like, why? And they were like, oh, because we can. And he's like, well, you can't. Well, you'll kill grass. But, you know, there's that. Yeah. I mean, so it is kind of nice being able to tell people that, no, you'll kill the grass. You can't go on it.
And here's a great example, okay? You've probably heard about San Diego and what they're doing at San Diego's Petco Park these past couple weeks.
No, actually, I hadn't
heard. Has Larry said anything to you about it?
No.
Oh, listen to this brilliant marketing scheme.
Oh, God.
And I say that with a grain of salt because I know what's coming because this is going to spread to other ballparks. I can see it now.
Oh, no.
But they created a golf course on Petco's field. It's 9 holes, but it really isn't. There's like 4 holes out in the park, or 4 greens that have shared holes.
Oh,
there's 2 holes on each green. And then there's tee off points from all over the ballpark up in the upper deck. And people can go and play golf there. They're doing this for a set couple of weeks at Petco, but they have a waiting list of people who want to come and do this.
Gosh.
And you know, if it happens at one ballpark and it's successful, guess what?
Everybody.
All the other southern ballparks, you can bet in the next couple of years, you're going to be doing the same thing.
You know,
these guys get no rest. Up in the north, they can't do that at our place.
You and I hadn't discussed this as a possible topic, but hearing that, I was talking with another friend of ours in the industry, and he was having a meeting with his front office. I don't want to say if he's majors or minors or you know, obviously it's baseball.
Yep.
But they were having he was very fortunate enough to be working with a front office that he could sit down with and say, okay, so is my job head groundskeeper for a baseball field or is my job head groundskeeper for a multi-use facility?
No, your job is a circus ringmaster.
Well, all right, you're taking No, I'm telling you this is a good thing because they wanted to sit down with him and have this conversation because there's a whole lot of different scheduling that goes into this.
Absolutely.
There's a whole different way of thinking about your job as far as going year round and going day round and having all of these pressures. And so they were sitting, he was really fortunate enough to be able to sit down with the front office and say, this is great. If we're going to do this, this is how we need to reorganize and restructure the grounds crew. And I don't know how you start getting front offices to start paying attention to that, but that, you know, maybe that's a conversation that, you know, more of our friends need to start having. Or trying to have. Obviously, you can't force it.
Well,
but
and this isn't unique to the major leagues. This is going on in minor leagues. It's going on in the
colleges
levels.
Yep.
So this is spread out through a lot of areas. Ball fields have become the three ring circus of whatever you can throw out there.
Yeah.
Throw it out there.
More so in the minors than the majors, actually, in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And what it has caused is groundskeepers not getting any breaks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something going on all the time. They expect you to be there, and your crew needs to be there, and the guys aren't getting. I think we've talked about this recently on one of our other shows, but
we did. Yeah, so we don't want to spend too much time on it.
We don't want to spend too much time, but you know, again, in the South, where we're talking about these ballparks and fields,
even more than the North.
Yeah, they're becoming playgrounds in the off seasons for everything else that goes on. So you're working all year round. That's why we love it in the North. Now, I say that, but there are things that are changing in the north. You've had ballparks up here that put on winter activities. Just recently, Boston, a couple of years ago,
ice
had
skating.
Their big. Well, yeah, there's a lot of hockey going on in ballparks lately. Boston had a winter fest where they put a toboggan slide and things like that. I remember pictures. I've seen old pictures of Wrigley Field where they put a ski jump in there one year. This was back.
Yeah, of course they did.
I believe it was in the 40s, if I'm not mistaken. when I was doing some research ahead of the show for with Roger Baird and Justin down there.
Yeah,
there was some old pictures of a ski jump down there in the 40s that they had put up. You know, so it's not unusual, but I'm seeing more of this stuff happening more frequently.
Yeah.
You know, any way that ownership or whoever is making these calls can put more things on. So, you know, us people in the north, we're getting our rest, but even we are getting, you know, some additional activities in the wintertime on our fields.
Well, or you've got the opposite effect, and I hope I don't get strung up for airing this part of our laundry in public, but... you ever see an animal that's been kept in a cage too long? That's my husband in the wintertime.
Yeah.
Come March, he's basically standing at the door looking at it going, can I go out yet? Can I go out yet? Can I go out yet? Can I go out yet?
Well, you know, you're right, because I'll tell you, here was my mental path typically when I was in Major League Baseball is, you know, you got to Thanksgiving and it was like, oh, thank God I can finally relieve. You know, I don't have to worry about watching the Weather Channel. I don't have to worry about weather. I don't have to worry about nothing like that. Just get up and do whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's great for all through the holidays. And then January 1st comes along and you start getting that itch for baseball again. So you get yourself busy by, okay, I got to order this for the year. I got to look at that. I got to go to these trade shows. Like, and you spend the month of January getting yourself re-educated and regenerated and ready to really jump in. And by February, by the time you get off that circuit, now you're itching to go. And finally, some point between February and March, you start working on your fields and you're happy again because you're outside. You can smell the, you can smell the dirt. You can smell the grass. And you're happy for a while. But after a while, you get bored of an empty stadium and I want fans in here cheering and, you know, and then opening day. And that's that was my typical mental state during the off season. You know, at first you're relieved. Then you're kind of re-energizing yourself educationally and whatnot, and then you're ready to jump. I can fully understand Larry's, you know, because I'm the same way. I'm, and even now when I do the Little League fields, it's the same thing. I can't wait to get back out on those fields at March. Right now, I can't wait to get rid of that out of my life for a while, so I can have some, you know, think about something else besides worrying about those fields.
We had a winter with, you know, not a lot of snow and not a lot going on, and there wasn't much for him to do, and so we bought a house.
because he's a big project guy.
He got bored, and so he started looking at houses, and then he said, "We should buy a house." I was like, "Oh, I kind of like the condo, you guys. We're getting a house." It's like, okay.
Well, buying a house is never a bad thing, in my opinion.
So. I hate it, but. That's okay. I'd rather pay somebody else to do all the work for me.
Well, on that
if
note,
if it's not on a baseball field, I'm not interested.
On that note, let's get into the tail end of football season. We'll take a break and listen to a word from our sponsor and come back with Ross Kirkab. For all of you Diamond Da Vinci's out there looking to extend your budget dollars as best you can, make sure you check out the open box section of the Beacon Athletics website. There you'll find items that have been discontinued in our product lineup, returned lightly used items, blemished product, or product we've used for demonstration. All products are new or slightly used and in great working order and are sold as is. These items can be yours at substantial savings. But there are limited quantities, so act fast when you see something you want. If you wait, the product may be gone. Products can be added at any time, so check the site often. just go to www.beaconathletics.com and click on Open Box on the green toolbar at the top of our homepage. These hot smoking deals are too good to pass up. All right, it's time again for our Out of the Park interview today. And with us, checking back for our second time this year, is our gridiron guru, Ross Kirkab. Welcome back, Ross.
Hello, Paul, Teresa.
Hello.
Glad to have you back. I hear you just had some fresh snowfall overnight up there in Denver. So that means that we're getting late into the season, and it's still football season in a lot of cases. We're in November. High school football is pretty much wrapping up in most cases. College has a few more weeks left, and the pros, well, they're just past the halfway mark. So, you know, if you're still in the in-season mode in football at this point, Ross, what are the challenges ahead that these groundskeepers have, and some of the things that football field managers can do to get their fields through the rest of the season?
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's a good topic. We just took about 3 or 4 inches last night here in Denver, and but the sun's already out and coming back, so I'm sure that's not going to affect this weekend's games. But and I would also mention too, soccer. A lot of soccer teams and clubs still playing this time of year, and even in professional leagues. So interesting time of year. Always looking back, was a fun time of year. I think it's a way to kind of separate yourself and be a little bit of a hero as a turf manager this time of year, when the snows start flying and the cold gums. You know, in all honesty, the expectation levels on your fields go down. There's, you know what I mean? If you can just get, in certain situations, if you can just get a clear field playable and safe, you are a hero.
So you've got a victory there, right?
Yeah. So that's my first thing, is relish the challenge, because a lot of times it's towards the end of the year, you're tired. But, you know, when you look back on your career, these are the weeks, the months, the times, the events that you really remember are those big snowstorm challenges or something like that, weather-related late-season championship football games. The games are bigger, the weather's bigger, so to some extent enjoy it, but it really does put a big challenge onto the turf managers out there, grass and turf, to get these fields open up for play and make sure the schedules can stay intact. So there's a lot of things we can talk about. Probably the two biggest ones to me are, you know, if you do have weather, snow, and ice removal, and or how do you get the field painted and prepped up in those kind of situations?
Sure.
Yeah.
And you know, so much has changed in recent years. You know, if you look through our trade magazines, and, you know, one of the things I've noticed through the past, 5 to 10 years, is a lot has changed in the equipment that's available now for groundskeepers for clearing snow off of fields. They've got specialized plows with tubular steel on the bottom, so it doesn't damage the turf. You know, I remember back at Old Memorial Stadium when they would plow it back in the 80s for football in the early 80s. You know, they were using just regular snow plows, and they would put a piece of rubber on the bottom for the scraper blade instead of steel, and kind of squeegee the field off with that. But now they've got some great specialized tools.
I was that rubber squeegee guy.
Yeah, I'm sure you were.
And, you know, that we actually got by on that pretty good. If you kept, you know, it's nowhere near, like you said, and you make a good point, nowhere near the more specialized equipment, plow tips, and different kinds of ways of moving different kinds of snow now off our fields that are more geared for doing on grass or turf. So you're right. Just like all other parts, you know, we're going to be get off my lawn, guy says, you don't know how lucky you are, kids, today with this equipment. But you make a good point. There is some real good stuff out there now, and still, you know, a lot of room for innovation and fabricating, you know, what you need, the tools you need to get the job done in your particular situation. Because, you know, one thing I've learned is every storm is different. And that was the first point I wanted to make. Every snow is different. Like the one we got here, our first snow in Denver, which is unusually late for the year, is like a spring storm now that the sun out, real heavy, wet, good snowball snow, make a snowman type of snow, you know. And as we get deeper into the year, we'll get those colder, fluffier, easier to move type of snows that you know, you have to treat kind of differently and maybe with different equipment. But good point, Paul.
So let's go back to your Bronco years. All right. How would you tell us how you would plan how to handle a snow event? And granted, all of them are going to be different, but what were the things that you looked at and how did you react to prepare for a game or to get a field so that you could clear it in time for the game? What was it that you typically had to go through the thinking process and how did you schedule your manpower?
Sure. Well, there's a lot. You're right. A lot does go into it. Every storm is different. And I guess the biggest distinction would be the years I spent on the practice facility where we didn't have covers versus the years at the stadium where we did do covers. And we can kind of talk about some of the differences with that. But some of the things that are similar between the two operations are basically planning, you know, and just like any other groundskeeper with any other time of year, you're going to be looking at the weather, charting all the scenarios up front. The other thing that was real important is to communicate up front with all the basic, you know, people that have an interest in the field, you know, the user groups, the coaches, referees, the sports organizations, things like that, is to establish a good line of communication because, as we know, forecasts and storms are dynamic. They change. You know, we used to, when we'd get into big storm scenarios, we'd be looking at essentially updating our plan every 12 hours as the big updates come out. So, okay, here's our plan for right now. And then tonight when the updates come out, we knew exactly when the National Weather Service ones back then, but you can get, you know, pretty continuous model updates if you really want to dig. But you'd update your plan as your information updates. So that's the first thing I do is be well planned out ahead. The other thing is this is not the time of year to be, you know, when the storm hits and stuff like that, to be driving around to Home Depot looking for shovels that everybody's running on. You know what I mean? Be sure. Prepared. I used to look at, you know, we get early snows in Denver. We actually have a September snowfall total, annual snowfall total. So my thought was Labor Day. That's the time we start looking towards, we better be ready for snow anytime. And, you know, we can get it pretty early. We've had early September snows, but I always kind of like to use those holidays as markers, you know, that, you know, July to me was time to start painting goalposts and looking towards football equipment on July, after July 4th. Well, after Labor Day, let's start getting ready for snow. So that involves a lot of different things from sideline heaters you might be using to shovels, squeegees, brooms, making sure you have enough of those, all your plow equipment, spare parts, you know, to pop one cotter pin on a plow operation where you get to save the field and not have a backup is just heartbreaking. So that's the other thing is, you know, get your plans in order, be well prepared, know that it's a dynamic situation that's going to change and get your equipment ready so that when the time comes, everything is what we used to call DEFCON 4. We're ready. By the time the storm hits, you know, everything is in the hopper, ready to go. The crews are scheduled, things like that. In terms of crew scheduling, that's the same kind of thing. It's dynamic. You know, there's certain times in the storm you're going to need people, maybe during, before. A lot of times it's before and after, and especially after. Sometimes you're attacking the snow as it comes, so that kind of changes the scheduling and stuff like that. The only thing I would really say on scheduling is on real big, heavy snowstorms, you really have to watch yourself and your crew. You start putting a lot of hours in. This is pretty high heart rate work, moving snow generally, you know. A lot of it's equipmentized, but these can be long days. So just be aware of that, you know, there's a lot of work involved with it, and we need to keep things reasonable, keep things safe in terms of how many hours you're running, a certain amount of equipment, times of day, things like that. Really focus on safety, because as you start getting into those long kind of sets of hours and days and things like that, that's what the first things that start to slip. You know, everybody wants to kind of do things quick and easy. So keep a focus on safety. And then, you know, as you start getting closer to the game, there's some things I think you get more involved with the game operations people, the referees, and keep your communication real tight with them. If you don't know where to go, that's always a good place to start. Is you know, I don't know it the high school federation, whatever, start with the referees and get a channel about let's start drawing up game day scenarios. If this happens, this is what we'll do. If this happens, this is what we'll do.
Did the referees dictate what they wanted you to, you know, in a game situation where you're snowing during the game, And is it like in baseball where the umpires have total control and they tell you exactly what they want? In other words, I can't go out and put drying agent on a mound freely. I have to have the umpire tell me to.
Wait. You know. I'm imagining that. It starts raining and all of a sudden the grounds crew guy comes out, holds his hand up and goes, stop the game, and goes and puts the drying agent on
the
mound.
Well, no, but you know.
But you're right. You can't do that.
Yeah, and because it becomes a thing about fairness. You couldn't go out. We couldn't go out between innings unless the umpires called us. Mm. You know,
sure,
we could
sure.
see that the mound needed it, but if the umpire tells us unless they tell us to come out, we can't go out there and do it. So my question was, in a game situation, does the referee, the head referee, tell you what lines they want cleared whenever you can in breaks in the game, or how does it work?
Or is that your judgment?
Right.
Well, my only experience is in professional football, and I imagine,
right.
you know, again,
right.
everything's dependent on the leagues. But in that situation, it's pretty similar. You check first with, you know, if you don't know, I'd always say check first. And part of the communications we would set up is identifying the communication path to the head referee on the field. So, mm-hmm. for example, we could get some things kind of set in stone before the game started. He would tell us the thing. And again, to answer your question, everything goes through the referee.
Okay.
You don't want to do something that's going to give an unfair advantage to either team, things
right.
like that. You know, so a lot of times before the game, the referee would say a thing, hey, you know what, once we're in TV timeouts, feel free to shovel sidelines and end zones, which meant goal lines and the sidelines of the end zone.
Right.
You know,
right.
those are the important first things in football. Was he out of bounds? Was he in the end zone? And mm-hmm. then you can pick away at stuff there. So there was some things we could kind of do kind of pre-approved from them.
Sure.
Anything specialty, obviously, we would wait and have them do at their discretion and things like that.
Sure.
Line clearing kind of gets to, once the game gets going, you know, you understand what the referees want, when you can go out there, what we can do and things like that. And try to make sure when you're doing that we're doing something and completing it. You don't want to start an operation where you get half the line shoveled or something. You know, sometimes you have to do the best you can.
Sure, sure.
But yeah, so, you want to check with the referee on that. And I think those are things that you should get established up front. You don't want to be during the game wondering right. who to talk to.
All right, so let's move on to something else now that typically, whether it's soccer or football, late in the season, late in the fall, another hurdle that you typically have is painting. You still got to keep painting the field, but temperatures are coming down, humidity stay up, you're not getting the drying that you used to get in the past. Or it's cold and you've still got to be able to paint. So tell us some of the things that you would do to tackle some of those issues that you might have in the colder part of the year when you're trying to get the last of the games in for the season, be it soccer or football.
Sure, sure. So again, you know, our tolerances and our expectation levels are down on painting, just like always with painting. If you're painting in a tough situation because of snow, or late season or cold temperatures, first off is focus on your functional painting before your decorative painting.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of football and, you know, soccer that's going on this time of year, there's not a lot of decorative painting, but
right.
and it's easier. You know, the scope is so much mm-hmm. smaller in terms of that, but the same mm-hmm. basic principles involved. So in football, yeah, get your lines, numbers, arrows, hashers all done. That's the functional painting that the game needs to be played, and then worry about your decorative logos and things like that and other
sure.
kind of issues, maybe some of the sideline stuff. So that's the first thing. The other thing is trying to get early in the, you know, in a game week or something like that, the earlier you can get your paint out. It does, you know, there's times where we'd have paint dry in literally a few hours in the summertime. That would take few to even several days in the wintertime, you know. And then in a stadium situation, you might be looking at putting field covers over it, which kind of just traps that humidity and moisture in
yeah,
there.
Yeah, exactly.
Makes it harder for the paint to dry. So we looked at, you know, and I, over the years, have tried so many different things and even talked with paint manufacturers about, you know, what the heck makes paint dry. And I couldn't call myself an expert on it, but essentially the way it was described to me, at least is how I remember it, is, you know, you've got the solids in the paint, different platelets, proprietary things, all the pigments and things, and then you've got water, and the water evaporates out the platelets and pigments kind of bind together in some kind of configuration over it to form a seal, a painted coat. So the idea is to evaporate water. That's what dries paint. Hmm. And anything you can do to kind of maximize that. One thing is to put less paint in and more water in. Now, some would say, well, that would actually take it longer to dry because you got more water to evaporate. But right. In my experience, I've kind of found that generally going with a little more dilute paint will actually tend to dry a little faster. I think it's when you get – if you go to the other end, I've had issues before where you say, okay, let's just put less water in the paint mix. And now we have less water to evaporate out. Therefore, the paint will dry faster.
Well, and the way that water works chemically and physically, as one molecule of water evaporates, it tends to pull another along with it because they tend to be linked together versus if you have paint in between the water molecules, it prevents that from happening.
Ah, well, that would make sense.
Nerd
from
alert.
From our science queen.
Tell us more, Mrs. Science.
So, yeah.
No, I love that.
She's it's getting a reputation on the internet, point. I hope you know.
She and well deserved.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt.
It actually kind of makes sense that, you know, it doesn't make sense what I've noticed. And the honest truth is I've never really done anything in manipulating my paint mixture that got things to significantly dry faster. Hmm. There may be some things that we did that kind of helped in a little bit. We did because, hey, what the heck, it didn't hurt and it might help. Now, one of the tricks is a lot of people do, and I don't even know where I got this idea, but is using denatured alcohol, a little bit of denatured alcohol in your paint mix. The idea is that from
From the bars, it sounds like you got that idea.
No. Not grain alcohol.
I have to emphasize, Paul, not the kind you can drink. And we'd buy it at like a local hardware, big box store type places where in the paint section, they'll have denatured alcohol in like gallon size cans and stuff like that. I think the theory behind that same thing is that alcohol will maybe start that evaporation chain or make it a little bit easier to come off. Sometimes it felt like that helped. Our basic recipe was a light dose would be an 8 ounces into a 5 gallon mix of paint. So mix your paint at whatever dilution you're going to do. Then put 8 ounces, you know, like a coffee cup, a cup of denatured alcohol. Stronger, colder weather, sometimes we try 16 ounces. Whether it's worked or not, I don't know. There could be some phytotox issues that you might want to test your areas first for. I don't know if it's always really good enough to do in every situation. I would, we'd tend to use that in the coldest, worst situation. So those are some dilution things you can do with dealing with the cold in the paint. The other thing is if you have the luxury and have a warm shop somewhere is keep your paint stacked. You know, a football field takes a lot of buckets of paint to paint. Yeah. So don't leave them out there in the cold where they're going to already start out freezing cold, you know, and start to maybe freeze up your paint gun or different parts of your paint machine, tubes, things like that. So that's another kind of thing we did was protect your equipment. If a paint gun freeze, we'd have a different ready one to change out real quick, or a bucket of hot water to dip frozen parts into is always a good idea, or even frozen fingers. trying to think some of the other things we would do with that, but really it you do a lot and you try all these things, but the bottom line is you can only affect paint drying so much. The biggest issue is trying to get out there and allow enough time in ahead of the game. So where you may be painting in the NFL on a Thursday Friday regime typically. We've gone out as early as, you know, Monday morning before, you know, 6-7 days to make sure that stuff gets down and dry. And quite honestly, your grass, even if it's still pretty warm and green, cool season grasses are starting to slow down their top growth now. They should be, even with the warm weather. So you're not as much at risk for painting too early in the week and then mowing off your paint.
Sure. Right.
This time of year. So go ahead and get it out there. The other thing to consider is a lot of fields have been painted several times by this time of year. Can our old paint job functionally get us through?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or can you go down with a lighter coat over top instead of your usual thicker coat?
Yeah. Or maybe we only do parts, you know, the important parts like the sidelines, goal lines, and this. So, again, every storm is different. But those are a few of the things we did to kind of manipulate the paint part of it in the cold weather.
So, and at this point, you know, you're not, like you said, the grass has pretty much stopped growing from the leaf stage, at least. It's growing down, you know, a lot of the carbohydrates are being channeled now down into the roots to get the root growth going. And so there's not a lot you can do to improve your turf at this point, short of sodding, if you're still playing at this time of year. And that's if you can get sod somewhere nearby, if they haven't, if the sod farms haven't closed down. So agronomically, at this time, at this point in time, if you're still playing, there's really not much you can do at this point, correct?
Well, I would tend to disagree with that. That I think it's the time of year.
I shouldn't say that because there are blankets.
Well, I mean, you know, in terms of top growth, yeah, you really can't change the basic cycles of grass and day length and temperatures and things like that. We can gently manipulate them, but when you say there's not much we can do agronomically, are you talking in one specific area, or you know?
Well, I'm talking about I'm talking about to improve, you know, as far as improving the field. At this point, you're just trying to keep the field together until the end of the season.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. If you're still playing, you know, you're not going to be going out there with heavy core aeration, things like that, and off-season projects. So, yes, your agronomic part of it, your fertility, your daily mowing, irrigation, soil management, and all those things really slow down this time of year. We used to kind of kid. It became ground management late in the year, more than it's turf management later in the year. I mean, it doesn't mean that all the same things for safety and playability are important, but yeah, you're exactly right. You're not doing nearly as much of all the things we do in the summertime.
Yeah, your main concern now strictly is traction. Now, not that you're not concerned about traction earlier in the season, but you're also concerned about the grass growth at that point in time. At this point in time, it's whatever it is, and you're just concerned about keeping good footing.
Yep, exactly. And level, smooth surface for ball roll and soccer, you know. We used to say that.
Well, that's true.
It's the time of year you put your head down and pedal for the summit. And so I think you're saying that kind of in a roundabout way that, you know, yeah, you can kind of pare down your priorities and focus into let's just keep a field playable and safe through the rest of the year. We're not worried about string trimming the edges and all those things we'll be doing in the summertime. So,
Ross, you used to do a lot of top dressing for traction on the football field. And I think you did a lot of it for the soccer, too, when you had a couple of soccer matches on your field, if I remember correctly. Is that something that continues into the later part of the season, or is that something that you find is only useful earlier in the season?
No, that's a good point. And I think really there's a playability part of it. I mean, typically most of the year we're top dressing for agronomic reasons, for soil health, dilution of organic matter, other things. Now, later in the year, you can top dress for basically what I call friction or grip, putting a little grit into your surface. You know, by the time of year you've had a lot of wear on the field, we may be with the precip, shorter days, you tend to get maybe a slimier, greasier type of surface. You know, on the top half inch of your soils on your playing surface. So top dressing with a good clean sand, if it's appropriate for the soil underneath,
That's
is
a
good
big,
good way
point.
To get Yeah. You don't want to go put top dress a light coating of sand into a heavy clay soil, for example.
Right.
My old teacher used to say that's how they make adobe and with sand and clay and grass.
Yeah.
So you really want to be sure if you're using sand. Now, there are other alternative amendments and things like that, that like some of the calcined or the baked clay things that can be really handy during this time of year. And again, going back to being prepared. One of the things we would always be prepared for was is some kind of calcined clay type product, soil amendment. Those are real good. So, for example, if you had a clay soil field, these are going to be more appropriate to add than a sand would. So the idea is, though, but more for agronomically, is you're putting it down to get a little grit on that surface and maybe help a little bit more with friction. Doesn't necessarily going to help a lot with cleats sinking in type traction, but some of the grip and slip, I think that really helps. And honestly, we would do that all the time late in the season just to keep that surface a little bit gritty.
Are you talking eighth of an inch or less?
Oh, yeah, eighth of an inch or way less probably. You know, I'm just talking light coating. Now, the idea was we would do it often enough so that we would never get to that slimy surface. You know, so the idea always, especially late in the year, because your grass isn't growing nearly as much, and if you put out a thick blanket, people don't realize eighth inch is a pretty good shot of top dressing.
It
may not seem
like
in our heads, you know. So I'm more looking like these 16th inch type of stuff. Maybe we would go out on a football field and spread anywhere from 5 to 8 tons on what is that, about 70,000 square feet roughly, counting the end zones and border. So again, that's a pretty light shot. But we would do it so frequently, almost weekly, bi-weekly, after every game, maybe a light shot as part of our renovation. Doesn't mean that everyone should be doing it that frequently. It's just our field conditions and things warranted it that time of year. But it is a good tool to use, and those amendments are real good. I mean, I've saved high school state championship fields just by going around and collecting some old calcined clay type products that some of the distributors had left over in the season. Brings up a good point real quick is, yeah, that's why you need to order the stuff early. We're at the end of the end of the kind of distributor season. And a lot of things like soil amendments and things like that might be plucked through. And I've had issues before trying to find this stuff late in the year.
That's a really good point.
I'm assuming then in the spring, you're coring that stuff down in and mixing it with the rest of the soil then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Soil and core at that time, you know, not necessarily every time we top dress are we coring, but
no. But I mean, after I'm talking about after the football season in the following spring, you're coring that, you're blending that calcined clay then down into the soil.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Exactly. Because leaving the stuff you spread to get you through December is going to be there, and then you will incorporate it later.
Because if you just leave that top layer of calcined clay at the surface, you're going to help hold moisture up at the surface more, and you know, if you get enough of a layer over the course of time of calcined clay on the surface of your turf, you're going to get shallow rooting because of it. Because the roots are going to want to stay up at the surface.
Very good point. And I think you'll do that normally in you know, like you said, the following spring.
Right.
You start doing your normal coring, things like that, or maybe just even after the season. But layers are never good.
Right. No.
I don't know of a good layer.
In a shot glass.
Sorry. On a cake.
On a cake.
And not in the soil.
Okay, so let's look at some of the agronomics now involved. And, you know, for those who have finished their football season recently, what can they do agronomically at this point, this late in the game, to begin to start the repair process of getting their field ready for the football season next July and August?
Sure. So one of the things that, you know, I think is a kind of underutilized tool that I like to talk about this time of year, and for the people, and again, not just football, soccer, and any other fields, or maybe baseball fields that are still, you know, kind of putting things to bed, as we say, for the winter, is late seed in the northern climates and cool season grass zones is a dormant seeding program. And not many people know how to do that very well or really utilize it. Most of us that are seeding cool season fields tend to look at spring, which I hate in terms of seeding right then. But, you know, the textbook one of late summer, August, September type of things, depending on your climate. And I'd really like to bring Teresa in on this, too. I imagine you've had some study and research on these kind of things. But basically, the idea of dormant seeding is that late in the fall, usually, and again, it depends on your latitude probably mostly, but also your climate, is seeding late enough in the year where the soil temperatures are cool enough that the seed doesn't want to pop, even if you get a little moisture on it. And that seed will sit there in a dormant state through the winter time. And then in the spring, anywhere from late winter to early spring, when the conditions start warming and the sun comes out and the soil temps warm, that seed will be in there and will germinate then for you. You don't have to go in and disrupt your fields in the springtime to seed it. Yeah, other ideas, you know, it's just a good time of year right now in terms of having sometimes, especially this fall, having good weather to do that work compared to the late winter or spring. And I think it's something that, you know, cool season grasses, if grown in nature, tend to drop their seed and they sprout the following spring. They kind of late dormant seed anyway. And I think it's a good thing to do and look at it, and has a lot of advantages. I'm not sure if you guys have any experience or thought in that.
Well, I know, you know, I was just, we were just doing some last minute sodding this past week or so at my Little League complex before we shut down. And I was out visiting our sod farm just a week ago, and I was talking to Paul Huggett, who runs Paul's Tree and Turf here in Wisconsin. And we were talking about seeding and when he seeds his farm fields. You know, he said, you know, he does, of course, a chunk of it in the normal time period of late August, early September. But he does more of it actually in the dormant end of the season, you know, in November and late October. And he said what he finds is that he can actually drop the amount of seed he's putting down in half or more when he dormant seeds, because what he has found is that every seed that he plants comes up, whereas the seed he plants in August and September, he said he won't get all that seed up because, you know, you've got so many different differences in environment around a sod field. Some areas are dry, some areas are wet, some areas are getting more sun than others. But by dormant seeding, they all get that equal moisture when the spring comes around and you've got the high moisture content in the soils. He said that every seed pops, and he said all he needs is to get one or two seeds per square inch come up. And what he finds is those fields that he dormant seeds, he's able to harvest in July, whereas the fields that he seeds normally in August, he might have to go all the way through a full growing season before he can even touch that stuff with a sod harvester, which I found very interesting. So he was able to cut back his amount of seed he had to plant to get the stand that he needs, and he could harvest that turf typically a lot faster, the stuff that he dormant seeded.
I always ask a sod farmer. I mean, nobody knows bluegrass than those guys. Teresa, what about you?
Well, what could be happening is that vernalization. One thing I noticed when I was doing a lot of my graduate work, which is when I did the most seeding I've ever done, is that there were a lot of seeds that had to go through a cold process before they would germinate properly, before we could get the germination rate up to what you see on that seed tag, which is going to be anywhere from 88 to 98%. And, you know, we had some tricks that we could use that I don't want to go into because they're not practical. They're only practical on a research level where you're looking at, you know, trying to get 50 seeds to germinate. But yeah, that cold processing, that cold process, that hardening off or vernalization, whatever you want to call it, can really be beneficial to a lot of different seeds. It's like you were saying earlier, Ross, it's part of that normal life cycle of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're dropping their seed. That seed is meant to wait. It's meant to come back around for the next growing season in a lot of ways. You know, different if you're talking about Bermuda grass or seashore paspalum, but when we're thinking about bluegrass, ryegrass, tall fescue, you know, you're keeping a lot with that natural rhythm, which, you know, sounds so hippie when I say it that way. You know, I just took science and hippified it. But
turf grass chakras.
Right. Your turf grass chakras. Exactly. But yeah, I think there's a lot to that. And absolutely. Like I said, I've never been in a position to be able to practice much of that. But I know that Larry, my husband, he is a big believer in it. He likes to keep a good seed bank going over the winter.
Sure. And, you know, you could even, in theory, do a little of both, depending on how things work out from your dormant one. I've heard a couple things. I've read some things maybe you've come across, or Paul, you've heard. One is that this works best with Kentucky bluegrass compared relatively to tall fescue and perennial ryegrass, the two other more predominant cool season grasses that we use in athletic fields. I don't know. I haven't, again, had that lot of experience. I've just read that in a few places. Maybe there is some sort of logical reason behind that. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yeah, I have heard that. Rye and tall fescue aren't going to be as they just don't handle the cold as well as the bluegrass.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, neither one is as tolerant. So.
Yep. And so their seeds wouldn't be very tolerant of it either.
And, you know, that could be too, no, that wouldn't make sense. I've just kind of read that and trying to figure out what that reason would be.
Yeah, if you're down in Kentucky or Virginia or Tennessee, you know, Missouri, those areas, you'll be fine with your tall fescue ryegrass. But Minnesota, Denver, Wisconsin, Washington State, you're not going to get a pain point from it, but it's not going to be as successful as a bluegrass.
Sure. And one kind of minor point, I have read a little bit about what you could call a dormant worm seeding season, worm season seeding for Bermuda grasses, some of the seeded Bermuda grass. And I think the way that's kind of, again, I'm speaking out of my element here, but more done kind of early spring, maybe even mid spring. You want to do it when it's below soil temps below 60 degrees at least, and that the idea is there when the summer heat comes and things are right condition, you'll be able to take advantage in the same way as you would with cool season grasses. And the other thing I like with dormant seeding, maybe you could speak to this more with your experiences, is the pressure it takes off your field in the spring if it is a worn field that, you know, getting out there at that time of year in late winter, early spring, and we all know that the our parks and school sports programs seem to start earlier
every year.
Yeah. I remember it used to be April. Now we're in, Valentine's Day hits and all bets are off. So this is something that, you know, kind of combats that trend.
Well,
one more thing real quick, Paul, if there's time to touch on time of year, is putting down your irrigation system and winterization things and a few thoughts on that. I see some mistakes in that regard. You know, like we've looked over most of the country this year, we've had a fantastically warm, dry fall so far. And I see a lot of people that tend to winterize their irrigation system based on a calendar or something like that, rather than really taking a kind of a dialed down approach that I like to take. Because as I've always said, you know, you don't want to flood anything, and there's ways to prevent that. But freeze breaks and pipes are a lot cheaper and easier to deal with than acres of lost turf. And, you know, not so much of an issue maybe where you guys live, although on some winters I imagine it is. Out west, it's a big issue. And I think one issue is we're winterizing too soon. Push it a little bit. You can put some insulation over any above ground components like your backflow preventer, things like that. That'll buy you a couple weeks before you're going to freeze out. Maybe put some insulation down in your valve boxes, but those aren't going to freeze generally. Anything underground isn't.
Anything underground, right? Because the ground temperature is too warm typically, and it's you know, we've got a huge complex with all of our pipes. I got one pipe that sticks up out of the ground, which serves the grounds crew area where we wash off equipment and stuff. And, you know, I've been running that on and off for the past couple of weeks. Whenever I know it's going to get below freezing at night, I'll just put a pencil stream through there and let they keep going. I want to shut my system off as late as possible. So I wait till the last possible minute to turn mine off. In fact, ours is getting blown out this weekend when we shut down the complex totally for the year. My crew leaves for the winter and everything. But, I mean, this is later than we've ever had it on.
Do you run the risk of ruining your heads? I mean, not necessarily. I mean, we're thinking about blown out pipes, but is there a concern that you could damage the very intricate machinery that's in the heads?
The ground temperatures are way too warm still.
Okay.
I mean, you've got to get several nights of temperatures in the 20s in a row to be able to, and you know, daytime temperatures to stay down, say, below 40 before you have to really worry about that.
Okay. And, so up here, that's really late November, December weather.
Some of that goes to the design of your system and how well it's put in. I mean, if you've got check valves and the right kind of things, generally your lateral lines and your heads are going to drain out at least. There are a little exposed on the top section to some cold nights and things like that. But generally, the issue is your backflow preventer, the stuff that's above ground. And so what I always say, Paul, and I was always just like you, I'd push it and push it. And people, you know, it's kind of backwards. You got to save those pipes. I'm saving grass. And, you know, in some years, it may be no problem. We can go in. But I just see, I've already seen a lot around the Denver area. You know, these typically start going up even in early October, some people. And this year, I mean, we were still in the 70s and had some 80s going. And I see some pretty hard, dry ground around here just because they winterize on the calendar. So you make a good point. You don't want to go too far with it. I think the other thing I always say is as you start getting colder now, look at it as more a monitored operation. So if you've got insulation and things, always kill your main gate valves at night so that if something were to freeze break, you're not going to just flood all night. You're only going to flood out what's there and available. Water during the day, we typically say in the summer, obviously for efficiency reasons, water at night. Water during the day and this time of year when you're pushing it later. Yeah. You're there, you can monitor things, and then you can kill the gate valves when you're done and get everything buttoned up for the night.
Well,
watch
this
your walkways for ice.
This time of year you want the evaporation during the day. Sorry, Ross.
Yeah, that's one thing. That's why you want to do it during the day, warmer temperatures. You don't want to be irrigating when you're not there. Make sure you check all your walkways around your facility because you can, if it's cold enough, tend to do this. And I'm not talking like Paul and I are pushing this stuff into the Christmas or anything. I just think we need to kind of make a push at early October in a lot of years and stuff. You're getting too early. Don't do it by when it's convenient. Do it by the year that's happening.
Well, and I'm not necessarily sure it's convenience as much as it is. I think, truthfully, I think fear. A lot of it is no. I think a lot of it is the irrigation companies pushing people to do it early. More
so
than
it
is.
They want them to replace a lot of heads.
Well, you know. I'm not sure. You know, I think it's because they're afraid they're going to get everybody bunched up at one time wanting to be blown out, and they don't want to miss that.
That's what it is. There's a game that goes on because you don't want to – all but the biggest landscape companies don't really want to buy a big trailer compressor and only use it once a year.
Good point.
So there's a big bit – a lot of pressure on the rental market to get a good compressor out. And so, yeah, they do tend to get stacked up. But I say that's another reason to delay it because by now everyone's blown out.
Yeah.
And I'd probably in Denver right now be looking just like you, Paul, would be to blow out now. And I can guarantee you everyone's already turned in the compressors for the year. One other point to be careful, a mistake I see a lot, whether it's not on athletic fields or lawns or anything, you see a lot of things getting blown out this time of year, especially on gear-driven rotors, is air pressure is a lot different than pneumatic pressure. And you want to have this done by somebody who knows what they're doing because you don't want to have too much air pressure in your line. You can just flat out burst pipes from the pressure. But if you start watching when you blow out, you'll see the water come out first, and then you're starting to blow out just mostly air with some misty water coming. Mm-hmm. Notice how fast those heads start turning once you get to air. Mm. There's a risk that you can kind of burn out gears and gear-driven rotors. So the idea here is to blow it out just till you get some air going, let things kind of settle out, do it in short bursts so you don't overheat any gear-driven rotors on your head. That's one thing I see a lot of people. They'll just turn on a zone and blow it for 30 minutes till they get every inch of water out. And that can damage heads, I think, more than pushing it late in the season, Teresa.
Yeah. Sure. Good point.
Well, Ross, we appreciate you taking the time today to give us some more insight into late-season football field care and getting the fields shut down for the winter. I think all that's left to do is for us to sit back and watch the last few weeks of the football season at this point.
Actually, is the show already over? I thought we just started. But no, it's been a good time talking with you guys anytime.
Ross, you want to go ahead and tell us the name of your company again and your email address? We'll have it on our website, but some of our fans don't go to our website necessarily, and this way they can write it down for themselves.
Sure. I'm doing consulting work now. My company is Championship Sports Turf Systems. Best way to get me is through email at turf, TURF, 444@gmail.com. And you can also get me on Twitter at Natural Grassman, and through Facebook, social media. I write a column for Sports Field Management magazine that appears on the back page every month. So that's another way to find me. My email is found there. I'm easy to find. So thanks, Teresa.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. Well, thanks again, Ross, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
All right, guys. Take care.
The holiday season is upon us, what with the turkey and stuffing and all the goodies that go with it. And ooh-wee, that's a mess of good food. And after that, you'll be joining the hustle and bustle of the holiday shopping season. I hope you have your athletic fields on your gift list, too. Our new 2016 catalog mails out after January 1st. But for right now, take advantage of the final weeks of our 2015 prices. And don't forget about the huge deals you can find on our open items page of the Beacon Athletics website. If you're not on our mailing list, call or sign up on the web today in order to receive your own copy of our 2016 catalog. You won't want to miss what we have in store in our next catalog. Sign up to get your copy now at www.beaconathletics.com.
All right, guys and girls, hold on to your butts. It's science time.
Hold on to your pants.
Okay, I was going for Jurassic Park. I don't know what you just did there, Yosemite Sam. Although that's appropriate, as we'll find out today while I try to describe some of this stuff. I tend to think in cartoons, so this might work to our advantage. You got a good Bugs Bunny in there?
I could, yes. I just wasn't prepared for it.
The only Daffy Duck I have is yoinks and away.
Just what I want, some more science.
Well, that's good, because that's what you're going to get today, Paul. You're going to get more science.
Please, Teresa, can we have more science? Please, 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 please.
I really want to keep talking about this wear tolerance thing.
It wears on me.
But it's so interesting. It all really right. is. I promise not to say anything worse than photosynthesis today. And I'm not even going to say photosynthesis, except to say photosynthesis. I'm doing it. Now I'm stuck in a photosynthesis loop.
Can't we talk about lignified tissues and
no, I'm
centrifuges
not.
And hypoflavonoids?
I'm not going to say those words because they just get lost in our brains. I'm going to use words that we all use on a daily basis today.
Well, to get serious, whenever we talk about football, and the last football show we had with Ross, we did a science part that we said was going to be multi-parted.
Yep. We were also talking with Alan.
If that is a word.
Yep. From Green Bay. That was episode 12, I believe.
Episode 12, yes. I remember that. That was in the third trilogy. Anyways, fourth trilogy. Wear is a huge thing with football, and that's why we incorporated this into the football shows. And so Teresa's going to carry on with her scientific dissertation on wear tolerance today. And it is excellent material. And all I have to do is remember what my part was that I was going to talk about. So hopefully it'll come back to me while we're talking about it. So take it away, Professor Teresa.
Oh, don't call me that. I do not have a PhD.
Oh, that's true. Take it away, teach.
There you go. Well, so as a reminder, last time we talked about the beginning of the testing of wear tolerance because we had had a discussion way back when Dr. Sorokin was on because John and I both were working on our graduate degrees at around the same time. I was using one type of wear tolerance machine and he was using another type or a wear application machine, I should say. And so John and I geeked out about that and, you know, it kind of sparked some interest in our fans and I wanted to just continue on a little bit more about that. So we talked about the beginning of where it all came from. And one of the things is how we define wear and how that happens in turf. And Cockerham put that very nicely and he broke it into three different sections, wear from friction and scuffing. So that's that crushing, frictiony kind of, you know, the more manual type of wear that we think of. And that's the above ground stuff that happens. I will say the word biomass a lot, and forgive me for that. That's all of the living tissues that are, you know, above the ground, the above ground biomass, all of the living tissues. He also broke it down into what happens below ground, compaction. Anything that happens from the concentrated, as he put it, concentrated weight distribution of the cleat and the foot. So looking at what happens to the roots, what happens to the rhizomes, anything that's below the ground. And also what happens to the ground itself and how that can impact how the grass grows. And then finally, the lateral shear injury. What happens when we pivot that foot or we thrust that foot so that we're pushing away in a different direction and actually physically tear the above or the below ground structures, that tearing motion that we have. And I said biomass, and I'm going to get back to that now because all of this is to define what is happening to the above ground tissues, the biomass above, all of that that we can visually see as wear and that we can visually measure in a subjective way as wear. But also, as we're learning, and we'll get more into this in another conversation, that we can learn to objectively measure as wear, how quickly the grass grows back or how much damage actually exists physically that we can measure that's measurable. So the biggest thing for this, and Paul, you're going to tell a story here in a minute, and I want to get back to this, but what really affects us the most as turf managers is what we can visually see above the ground, but also what happens to our crowns, which is the living part of the plant, the heart of the plant, so to speak, not heart as in human heart, because it's got nothing to do with the circulatory system, but heart as in where all of the life is. And if you kill that crown, you lose the plant.
Right.
But if you can maintain and protect that crown, you can get growth back. And so that's another way that as we've moved on and learned more about wear tolerance, that we've started to define all of this wear tolerance is what is the immediate after effect, and then what kind of reparative regrowth can we expect, if any? Right. Yeah. And so, oh, yeah?
I don't want to stop you if you were on a roll there.
No,
go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to, you know, as Teresa and I were discussing this second chapter, as she was talking to me about this, I said, you know, it reminded me of the story of taking care of Oriel Park during the 93 All-Star game, where we had over 800 VIPs crammed into our very, very small foul territory.
Quick question, if there's 800 of them, how important are they actually?
Well, they are. They all have money.
Right. Oh, very important. My bad.
That's how it is in baseball, in those big shindigs. But
baseball and politics.
Yes. And, you know, so there and to kind of set the stage, we were in the middle of what was the worst summer patch season in history in Maryland at the time. This is 1993. And my field was already under tremendous stress because even though I had treated preventatively for summer patch, we were still getting hit, I would say, somewhere in the 5-8% range of being affected on the field.
And summer patch is the one you can't actively treat during the disease process, right? That's the one you have to treat beforehand.
Yeah, that's the one you have to treat way beforehand.
Yep.
And we learned a lot about that in the last few years of Memorial Stadium and the first couple of years at Oriel Park. But you know, 5-8% doesn't sound like much, but it's a lot on a major league field. And so I was battling that. But we had leading up to the All-Star game, or the All-Star, three-day All-Star period, we had seven or 10 days of temperatures of 100 degrees or higher every day, and nighttime lows not getting down below 80 in the city, inside the city. So we were really struggling with our turf. And it was probably one of the worst times of my career in the Orioles was during that All-Star break, because I knew the grass was in so much trouble and there wasn't much we could do about it. And the worst day of the year, or the worst day of the event, is the day before the All-Star game. It's not the day of the All-Star game. It's the day before, when they have all those extra events, the hitting contest, the practices, all the sponsor stuff that goes on. Mm-hmm. And it went from 9 a.m. till 5 o'clock that evening. Mm-hmm. This was before they did the home run hitting contest at night. It was done during the day. It was taped, and then it was shown that night in this situation. So they were out there the whole time the sun was beating on the grass. Never a chance for us to go out there and cool it down with irrigation. There was just no time. Mm-hmm. And so the foul territories just got beat to hell with what I call friction wear. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of flat shoes. All the special guests, they're not wearing spikes. And they're standing out there, and they're moving around. They're shifting their feet, and they're just grinding.
Grinding.
They're just grinding those cells in those plant walls. Just, you know, it's like, I don't know, what would you compare it to? Like taking a mortar and pestle and taking some grass leaves, putting it in there and just squishing the hell out of it.
Yeah, taking the guts from the inside, putting them on the outside.
As I saw this going on, besides the fact that it was physically making me sick.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually had almost had a nervous breakdown that day. Towards the end of the event, we decided to call a concessionaire in the stadium and said, you know, do you guys got ice left? Because it was like 102 degrees that day. But they had ice left in the stands around the stadium. And I said, I'm going to send our truck up. Can we get all the ice that you have left in the ballpark? Mm-hmm. So it ended up filling up a couple truckloads of ice. And as soon as the events ended, we went down there in the foul territories and we top dressed the worst areas, you know, mm-hmm. which were typically from about between the coaches' boxes, from the third base coaches' box around behind home plate up to the coaches' box. And we just doused them with ice, and then came right behind it with water to try and flush that cold temperature down into the turf, give it something mm-hmm. to kind of get it under control and cool it off and hopefully help to improve the turgidity of that plant from what it had just gone through. Well, and the next day, let me finish real quick here. The next day, certainly we could see a difference in the turgidity of that turf. We had a 2-week homestand right after the All-Star game, and we lost a chunk of that turf in the foul territories during that homestand, which was obviously the leftover effects of the wear. But as you stood over it, you could see any place there was aerification holes, because we had aerified just a couple weeks before that. The grass was alive, and you'd see this beautiful tuft sticking out of there because the crown was below grade. It was in those aerification holes.
Right. Well, and you just stole my thunder by saying that. This is a good story that I wanted to make sure we told on the air for a bunch of different reasons. Paul, what schooling did you have that told you to do that?
It was common sense.
Yeah.
It was so hot, and bluegrass is just not meant to grow in that kind of weather. And now you add all that stress in there. You've got to do something to relieve it. And it was just common sense. More than anything else.
It was your instinct. Yeah. It was what you knew without knowing why you knew it. And that's that art. That's the reason why we call ourselves the Diamond Da Vinci's. It's the art side of what we do. There is science behind it. And what I can say probably happened, you didn't so much perk it up by making it colder as much as you did a couple other things. First of all, you stopped the stress response that was going on from the heat, which was good because it had stress from heat, or it had heat stress and it had wear stress. And so you canceled out the heat stress. That helped the plant significantly right there, more than likely. Kept it from getting a double whammy. You also flushed away the blood and guts. you know, just like if you have a dead body with blood and guts on the outside, you get rid of the blood and guts, you just have the dead body. It's not quite as offensive. It's just, you know, you got rid of the slime, you got rid of the muck, you got rid of the really truly dead parts that had been separated from the rest of the plant, all of that, because you flushed it out and you watered it out and you watered it away. So that helped a lot too. So you made it look better that way. You also gave it some water, which helped to perk it up, like you said, with the turgidity a little bit, helped to perk it up and keep it standing up. So a lot of those things were really good as far as halting some of the major stresses that were going on in that plant. But the other thing I really liked about this is because it takes a good look at that friction and that scuffing wear tolerance, which is the one that causes the most visual damage.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's the one that we try to avoid. And that's why we hate marching bands on the field, because that's the most of the damage that they do is that friction, that scuffing, that tearing.
And that, because of that, you have seen products that have been developed to cut that back. Now, every park, and I'm not just talking major league, but minor league, colleges, they all use turf protectors around home plate area now, because every day you've got people standing around there in flat shoes, and they're shuffling around your feet, and that's when all that crushing of the cells occurs.
Yep.
And so now we put fabric down there, and that absolutely alleviates all those issues. Mm-hmm. Now, would I have been able to do that for the All-Star game? No, because MLB doesn't let you do that. But that's why those products were developed to relieve that stress from those plants in those areas.
Yep. Well, and that really is kind of our biggest method here for combating this. And we'll go into next time. We'll talk about some of the ways that the plant actually, because that's what we were going to do today, but I think we need to focus on this instead. We'll talk about ways that the plant gets around that wear stress, but the ways that we can combat it is, as a turf manager, is to try to alleviate all of those pressure points as much as possible where we can. And it's like you said with the aerification, I know a lot of people would be quick to go, oh, well, you had gotten rid of the compaction. No, not as much, because you had aerified well before the event. So what was actually happening is that you had protected your crowns, because when we think about when we have an aerification hole, that crown actually, you know, the soil level actually drops below the surface level of the field. And so we end up with grass that germinates and has its growth point and its crown point slightly below the main surface of the field. So protecting those crowns, putting down your mats, putting down your the blankets, like you said, mm-hmm. or putting down the flooring, the specialized flooring, doing yep. any of that. And sometimes even top dressing can really help to protect those crowns and prevent them from getting too much damage from absolute wear. But it's also a really good demonstration of the different types of wear that we see. And another thing that we can talk about in another episode is the way that now scientists are trying to both tease apart all of these different wear forces. So like Don Sorokin was talking about, they use their different pressure plates to try to figure out where all of the dynamics of the wear are coming from. So they try to tease them apart so that they can better understand them and measure them. And then they try to put them back together. Because what they found, and this was the very first person to look at wear tolerance in turf grass, found that we generally have to accelerate or speed up the wear process in order to study it effectively and in a timely and effective manner so that the data that we have is somewhat useful within a short amount of time. Otherwise, it could drag on for years. and we really need to see what's going on, especially when we're talking about creating and breeding new turf grass varieties.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're trying to do now is to better understand all of the components so that we can put them back together more accurately. Instead of actually running a football game or running 10 football games in a row, we can accelerate it, get the same effect, get that same objective, you know, trying to make it more objective and less influenced by the actual speed of it, or maybe we've got the wrong kind of compaction or the wrong kind of stress. Again, going back to what John and I were talking about, the differences between our machines, which we both chose for different reasons, but getting that accuracy back in so that we can start looking at breeding new varieties.
Hmm.
So it's that a lot.
It's a lot to cover and it's impossible for us to cover it all in one show. And in this case, two shows.
Don't want
and
to, yeah.
So we will come back with another segment on this. When I'm good and ready for another chunk of science.
I don't care if you're ready or not. We're coming back when I'm ready.
Well, thank you, Teach. That about closes the book on this. What was that? I dropped the. Somebody opened a bottle while I was doing that.
Oh.
About closes the book on this show. And be sure to tune in next time to the Diamond Adventures podcast for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is, it's all free because, you know, who's going to pay to go to school to learn this science, really?
I'm still paying.
Is that what we're supposed to do? Oh, you're still paying now.
Still paying. Our official webpage for the show can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find our show notes. This week we'll have some of the key points that Ross made, especially as far as taking care of our cooler season turf or cool season sports turf. And we'll also have any pictures or papers or links or photos, anything that we talk about during the episode. If you're new to the show, we also have our pictures and bios up there if you're curious to find out who exactly you are listening to.
Well, right now you're listening to me because I'm going to tell you we'd love to hear from you. You can email Therese and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com, where you can send us your questions or comments on our show or any good or bad things that you'd like to say about us or the show. If you have show ideas, you can send those along too. And by the way, for those of you who are listening to this podcast on Apple iTunes, please, 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 please send us, please review our show for us on there.
We're not desperate or anything.
No, not at all. Oh, and by the way, we'd like to let people know that we've joined a new podcast website called baseballpodcast.net. where we've joined their family of different baseball podcasts. So that's another avenue that you can find our podcast on the internet. Again, it's baseballpodcast.net.
And if you happen to be a person who enjoys using Twitter, our Twitter handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's @DiamondDaVincis. We're not crazy active there, but check in with us now and again. We sometimes have something interesting to say.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, I bid you goodbye.
Adieu.